welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 12 years after Harrisburg State Hospital closed as part of a national effort to move people with serious mental illnesses into the community, people are not getting the care they need. They wait months to see a doctor. They cycle through homeless shelters while hoping to be admitted for long-term residential care. Those who do find assistance often don't get enough time with licensed therapists. State funding has been stagnant since 1992, and legislators don't see a funding increase as a priority. Health systems in the region have closed some mid- to long-term mental health units, focusing instead on acute care needs tied to the opioid addictions. And with funds once earmarked to state hospitals now distributed to private companies, executive salaries are soaring, while some of the most vulnerable people in the mid-state are falling through the cracks. Through the Cracks is the title of a series of stories that investigate how this happened, who's responsible, and what can be done about it. WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Schultes produced Through the Cracks, and he's with us today. Brett, thanks for being on this program today.
Good morning, Scott. Good to be here.
All right, so what are some of the things that you learned through your reporting?
It really was a learning process, and it took some time to do. It was really shocking to me to learn about how flat the funding had been for so long. And to really understand that, I guess I had to go back and learn how state funding has sort of evolved out of the old state mental hospital system, which had been dismantled over the years. So I think, you know, the first big takeaways and the things that I started hearing from one person after another, and these are people who have spent a lot of time working in this sector, was that funding was flat or in decline, that people were waiting a long time to get services, and that when people do get services, there aren't enough professionals in Pennsylvania who are able to be properly funded and who are able to do the work that needs to be done.
So how is this different when we're talking about treating mental illness? How's it different than acute care when someone goes to the doctor and says, I have a physical ailment? What's the difference between treatment for a physical ailment and a mental illness?
There's a real movement right now for what they call mental health parity, where more people are pushing to make sure that mental health conditions are treated in much more similar way that physical health conditions are treated. As you say, if you go to the doctor and you present with high blood pressure or high cholesterol, they start you on a routine, and you know, a lot of things happen before you get to the point where you're at the emergency room, hopefully, or where you're in a hospital stay. That's not the case with mental illness, and there are a lot of reasons for that. And you can't just squarely blame, you know, the state or health systems or the insurers. There's a lot of factors at play there, including the stigma around mental illness.
And that is one of the main questions that I had for you, and I'm sure it's something that you address in Through the Cracks. But that stigma, it may not be as pronounced as it once was. I mean, we know at one time when someone was considered to have a mental illness, they were institutionalized. Mm. And in some cases, you never heard from them again, even their own families. But that stigma still is present today, that many people who suspect they have a mental illness or a family member who would encourage someone to get treatment for a mental illness, that they're afraid to talk about it, that it's not treated by society like a physical illness.
Right. I would agree with that. And it's important to remember that many other medical conditions that we now don't have any stigma around, once did have that stigma. There was a time where people were ashamed to talk about a cancer diagnosis, or they were ashamed to talk about a diabetes diagnosis. And now, of course, we don't feel that way. But with mental illness, there is still some of that stigma. And I think, you know, one good thing we might be seeing that's coming out of all of the opioid reporting that's been done over several years, and there was a effort to mainstream the idea that we have an opioid crisis, because we do. And I think one thing that's come out of that is more open ideas towards the other factors that are related to that crisis. And we know the high levels of what we would call comorbidity between drug use and mental illness. And so it's natural then to move on to talking about the mental illness itself, because there's a lot of new research out there that suggests that, for example, our drug problem in this country had been happening, and rates had been increasing since even before opioids became so widespread. And that suggests to many that the real problems are not being addressed, the other things that are at issue there beyond just the drug use. So, yeah.
But at the same time, that stigma still does exist. I mean,
it does.
You had told me in the course of producing this series that it was fairly simple, fairly easy to find professionals, to find experts to talk to about mental illness. But finding families who have gone through it, finding an individual who has been treated for a mental illness, not the easiest thing to do because there still is that stigma.
That's true, and it touches so many aspects of a person's life. And it's important to remember that when we talk about people with mental illness, we're not only talking about those who might be unable to work and might have been on Medicaid for many years or even staying at one of the community residential treatment facilities. We're also talking about a lot of people who do have jobs, who do have their own homes or live with family. And so there's still a lot of that fear that, listen, if you mention that you have, like I said earlier, something like high cholesterol, you don't worry about your employer coming in and saying, well, you know, we might let you go. But there's still that idea that mental illness could affect your employment. Mental illness could affect the way others in the community look at you. We have a lot of other debates right now. Every time there's sadly, another mass shooting, we have people bringing up mental health. We need to talk more about mental health, but it doesn't ever really lead anywhere. There's a sort of a nebulous idea that we're going to prevent certain people from purchasing firearms. One thing we don't see is any more resources being invested in mental health services every time that happens.
And it's probably a good time to say, when I have talked about mental illness and mental health in the past, as it relates to some of those violent episodes, that many people in the field, many experts will say that those who suffer from a mental illness, the overwhelming majority are not violent people.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
Pennsylvania, like many other states, at one time had a network of state mental hospitals, and mentioned Harrisburg State Hospital. They started closing them down because at times we realized that people with who were living with mental illnesses should live in the community, not away in institutions. How's that tie in with mental health care in Pennsylvania today?
Yeah, and I think most experts today would agree that that was by and large a good idea, to move people into the community as much as possible. It really all stems from a U.S. Supreme Court lawsuit that basically the result of which they dictated to the states, you have to now be a mental illness or disability is not reason enough to keep somebody locked away essentially from society. So there's been that push to move everybody into the community. The thing is, this is where it gets into the funding structures of the state. And that's where we begin to see how funds were dispersed into various counties across Pennsylvania. And that's where, when you really drill down on those numbers, you can see that we've had funds that have not increased at all since the 90s, and then actually decreased 10% across the state under the Corbett administration. So we're not talking adjusted for inflation. We're talking about the funds themselves. There's less funding today for community mental health services than there was 20 years ago. And of course, everything else has gotten more expensive, and people haven't stopped having mental illnesses. And we know that in some demographics, things like depression, anxiety, and even suicide are on the rise.
But explain to me why money is so important. I mean, I know it's an obvious answer that there can be more resources, but why is funding so important when we're talking about trying to treat mental illness?
Well, I think it is an important question, because if you don't put into the impact, then merely what we have is, you know, a more efficient state budget, I suppose. But the thing is, at least the people I talk to who work on the county level to try to provide services say that they've made their case with a lot of data as well. They presented to me that funding cuts lead to fewer professionals who are working, doing things like going to homes to provide services. The most obvious probably answer is fewer beds, so to speak, fewer apartments or places where a person can stay. And it just becomes harder. There sort of becomes an effort to cut corners. not cut corners of services, but sort of get by with less. And, you know, that has a lot of different impacts on the actual treatment.
You mentioned that you talked with a lot of people on the county level. We hear from one here in Dauphin County. Explain who we're listening to and what he has to say.
This is Dan Eisenhower, who is the administrator of Dauphin County's Mental Health and Intellectual Disability Program. And he's an interesting person because he actually presided over the dismantling of Harrisburg Hospital. So I think he's talking here a little bit about some of the challenges with providing that initial treatment for people with mental illness.
It's a surprising number of people that their first contact with the mental health system is through crisis intervention through our local emergency rooms. And then of them, a significant portion, about 3/4 of those new contacts end up being hospitalized as their first contact with the mental health system, which, again, if you're doing a parallel to the medical system, the idea that a first contact with the medical system would result in a hospitalization 3/4 of the time, you know, it doesn't even compute.
And what he's saying, we've heard so many times, in fact, from so many different agencies, so many different people. I think about the Department of Corrections with the number of people who are incarcerated that have been diagnosed or maybe haven't been diagnosed but suffer from a mental illness. We've actually had people say that our prison should not be where those who have a mental illness should be treated. And I think we could say that about a lot of other agencies as well.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's the need and always ends up going somewhere. So it's a matter of who ends up spending the money for those services. And there are a lot of programs on the county level to try to divert people with a serious mental illness from ending up in prison. But that's another fact that you point to, which is that a lot of people for a lot of people, their first treatment either ends up being an emergency room, as Dan talked about, or actually in the prison system, whenever it's flagged that, okay, perhaps this person's criminal activity, which oftentimes, by the way, is sort of just things like harassment or, you know, being in the wrong place or they're not supposed to be, is actually related to a serious mental illness.
If the state isn't providing these services in the community, who is?
The state is supposed to be facilitating these services, and they have a real requirement and mandate to be doing that. Now, to be clear, they're not the end provider throughout the state. There are private companies that are either nonprofits or sometimes for-profit companies that are funded through the state, through that money that used to go to the state mental hospitals. So we have a patchwork of companies across Pennsylvania that are providing the quote-unquote beds or the also going to homes and going to family members and trying to connect them with those services. So that's part of the investigation as well, is looking into those community service providers to make sure they're doing a good job and to make sure that, you know, frankly, that they're using taxpayer money well, because this is one of those cases where taxpayer money does end up getting outsourced to the private sector.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're speaking with WITF's Transforming Health reporter Brett Schultes about a new series that he has produced called Through the Cracks, that addresses mental illness and the treatment for mental illness here in Pennsylvania. I'm curious, Brett, Through the Cracks. I mean, it puts a picture in a lot of people's minds, but why that title?
Yeah, and I do just want to say one thing, which is that I'm not the only person involved in this project. This is really a collaboration. I'm working with some other reporters here at WITF, also on the you know, this is a multimedia project with a TV side, a radio side, so I don't want to take too much credit. But Through the Cracks, I mean, this series does look at problem areas in mental health services. So we're targeting people who didn't get treatment or enough treatment, or people who tragically have lost their lives or taken their own lives. So that said, this series is also going to be focusing on some of the things that are working. So I don't want to paint a picture that it's only a story about people who didn't get services. But I think that it's easy to see that metaphor for a lot of that.
What does work?
Well, I think that one thing that really fascinated me was hearing from a man with a schizoaffective disorder who has been battling that for the better part of 30 or almost 40 years. And he's doing pretty well right now because his medications are working for him. And he said, just without me really asking him about it, he said, you know, the one thing is he hears about a lot of efforts to cut funding for Medicaid. And he said, you know, for him, Medicaid has really been a lifeline that has helped him to just live his everyday life. And he's someone who, when you talk to him, my first thought is, boy, this guy's just sounds like just you or me. But at the same time, you know, he's had a stroke and he's had some very serious results as a result of his schizoaffective disorder. So he's not somebody who's going to be, you know, going and getting a job anytime soon.
Something else that you and your colleagues look at in the series is that how other public policy issues are related to mental health. Explain
right.
that.
Well, for example, the first example I used was the opioid crisis. So that's one instance where we know that oftentimes it's undiagnosed mental illness that leads someone to self-medicate. Self-medication often takes someone down the road of prescription drugs and from there to heroin. So that would be one example. Now, another example I'll present is the idea of suicide. I do want to say it's important to note that not everybody who commits suicide is considered to be somebody who has a serious mental illness. There are a lot of life change factors that can lead someone into a spiral of sudden depression and suicide. But for a lot of people, suicide is the result of a lifelong battle with a serious mental illness, such as, you know, bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. And you know, that's some of what Mr. Walter talked to me about, the man with schizophrenia. So affective disorder, you know, who fortunately he did not commit suicide, but he came close.
You do address suicide in the series. In fact, someone who took his own life was Joshua Stoner.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Joshua Stoner.
Yeah, Joshua was 19 whenever he killed himself. And Joshua was someone who I spoke with his mother, his father, and his sister. And, you know, he came from a great family and they really tried to help him. But from his early teen years, he struggled with very serious depression.
And you mentioned that you did speak with Joshua's family. I get the sense that at least his father, maybe the rest of the family, was pretty devout, a religious family.
His mother is in the ministry, and his father's very active in the church as well. And I think with the father, he spoke a lot about how this challenged his faith and how it also shaped his faith and the way he looks at other people.
Well, here is Joshua Stoner's father talking about his faith.
The concept that God had a purpose for this and planned this is, I think, weak theologically, but also say from a human standpoint, any pastor that might try to go and spin that tale to someone who is hurting, you're lucky you just don't get an uppercut and get dropped on the ground right there. I'm unbelievably insensitive.
And there's a man you can tell is in real pain for the loss of his son.
Yeah, it's true. And the whole family spoke very openly and emotionally about it.
I imagine, much like the coverage of the opioid crisis, people might have their own stories to share. We said a little bit earlier that it was a little bit of a challenge to get people to share their stories. But what are you looking for?
I am looking for personal stories. And this is not a series that we're just going to put out there and then walk away from. We plan to continue reporting on mental health problem areas in Pennsylvania for the next half a year to 9 months. So I do want to hear from people who either live with a mental illness or who have a family member or had a family member who did. So we want those personal stories. We also want to know what we might be overlooking in terms of problems. We are seeking to shine light on some of those problem areas and hopefully have some information that could guide people towards policy improvements.
Brett Schultes is WITF's Transforming Health reporter. He and his colleagues have produced the series Through the Cracks. And Brett, we look forward to hearing about this, shining a light on probably one of the most important issues that that we face today. Brett, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Many Americans don't have a vast knowledge of the nation's history and maybe know even less about the period when America won its independence from Great Britain. In school, we learn about the highlights like the Boston Tea Party, Lexington and Concord, the Declaration of Independence, Washington crossing the Delaware to take Trenton, and finally Yorktown. But there is much, much more to the story, and it's described in a new book, and the title says it all. Rethinking America from Empire to Republic by John Murren. Mr. Murren can't be with us today, but historian Andrew Shankman of Rutgers University in Camden is. Professor Shankman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that title, Rethinking America from Empire to Republic. Why do we have to rethink America?
In many ways, I mean, John Murren's most profound insight really overturns the assumption that most Americans have about why the American Revolution happened at all. I think there's a certain sense out there that the American Revolution happened because over a very long period of time, people living in North America began to feel less and less British, and by 1776 it just seemed ridiculous to them to be governed by a foreign distant power that was so unlike them. And what John Murren's life work has really shown is that almost the exact opposite is true, that in every measurable way, over the course of the 18th century, and getting more and more intensely true as you get closer and closer to sort of the 1760s and 1770s, American colonists actually began to identify themselves very proudly as more and more British, identify with British culture, identify with British politics, British society, British economic forms, and in fact be very devoted and loyal in all sorts of ways to the British Empire, which then forces us to confront why that process would have culminated with such a bloody and violent clash that led to a revolution and then the Declaration of Independence. And so a lot of his essays in the book are aimed at trying to examine actually what's a very difficult question, not a very simple and easy question.
As you said, that kind of goes against the thinking of what most Americans believe today, that they were becoming less and less British. And as Murren says, becoming more and more British. Give us some examples. There were some real benefits to the colonist to being part of the British Empire.
Yeah, so the British Empire is actually an incredibly successful enterprise. I mean, between the early 18th century and around the mid-18th century, between, say, 1710 and 1765, it became the most impressive and powerful empire probably since the heyday of ancient Rome. And in 1763, when the British, with a great deal of assistance in both materiel and manpower from the American colonists, defeated the French and vanquished them from North America, it controlled virtually all of the Atlantic Ocean, much of the Caribbean, and virtually all of the North American continent of what's now present-day the United States and Canada. What that led to was a vast and very rich and lucrative commercial enterprise zone, in a sense, which only people who were part of the British Empire got to trade in and got to be part of. And the American colonists benefited a great deal from that relationship. So there are all sorts of ways in which, over the course of the 18th century, Americans began to see themselves as having a great deal of benefit to being British. They modeled their universities after being British. The wealthiest Americans sent their sons to Britain to be educated. Certainly those who couldn't do that imitated British cultural forms. If you look at, if anyone ever goes to, say, the great houses in Virginia, they're all modeled on British country estates. All those houses date from the 1730s and 1740s as people are really beginning to embrace this British identity. Or Philadelphia, which is the city that I live in, if you go down to the old city there around Independence Hall, what you see is a lot of housing and a lot of sort of street formation and a lot of sort of cultural expression that's consciously modeled after trying to be British. So yes, in all sorts of ways and examples, the American colonists are actually quite devoted subjects of the British king well into the 18th century.
Right. The traditional story is that Britain needed to repay or recoup the money they spent fighting that French and Indian War, which was really a world war, but called here in North America the French and Indian War, that this is why some of the taxes like the Stamp Act and some of the other taxes on tea, that's why Parliament imposed these taxes. Talk about the relationship between the French and Indian War, those debts, and what led up to the American Revolution.
Yeah, I will. And Murren has a wonderful essay, and it was one of the shorter essays in the book also, so people could read it rather quickly. But it really does look very closely at the connections between what is called globally the Seven Years' War, and yes, in North America it's called the French and Indian War, and then the coming of these imperial conflicts. And there are connections, but it turns out that they're much more complex and not as straightforward as we might think. And so it is the case that the Seven Years' War is an incredibly costly affair. The British borrow heavily and almost double the size of their already large national debt to win this war, although it's money well spent. As I say, they conquer all of North America, they conquer all the West Indies, they give a little some of it back later, but they certainly conquer all of it. And they're the unprecedented world power as a result of winning this war. And in the course of the war, the American colonists devote a lot of, as I said, material and manpower to the war effort. What comes afterwards, then, is what Murren calls a problem of sort of imperial integration. Okay, now you've won this huge, vast empire. The empire was big before, but it's even bigger now. It's really sort of become the only serious power on the globe, or at least in the Western Hemisphere. And how exactly do you fit it together, and what do you do about it? And it turns out that that's a complicated question, and there's a real range of debate within British policymaking circles about how to organize this new empire and how to oversee and administer it. What's interesting is that, and the essay goes into this detail. I don't want to take up too much of our time with going into the nitty-gritty of it, but what the essay that I'm talking about from the book shows is that the French and Indian War really shows at least two lessons for how to administer an empire. And the way in which they win the war, and I won't go into a lot of the detail, but in winning the war, very shrewd ministers like William Pitt, who people probably might have heard of this name. He's very well revered in the colonies. That Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is named after him, among other communities. William Pitt manages to actually convince the colonists to voluntarily raise taxes to support the French and Indian War, to quarter troops, to support the British troops with barracks and other provisions during the French and Indian War, and also really respect and revere the presence of the British military, and to the point where the American colonists ask for British troops to remain in North America after that war to protect the frontier. Now, if you think about the coming of the colonial conflict with Britain, it largely centers around those things, being told they have to pay for the cost of empire, being told they have to quarter troops, and then becoming really, really angry and disrespectful of the British military. What the essay shows is that during the French Indian War, those same things can actually be accomplished quite effectively and well with the colonists' really happy cooperation with it. So what changes after the war is not what the British would hope the colonists would do, but the way in which they approach them. And the way in which they approach them is to become much more dictatorial and demanding rather than figuring out ways to get them to voluntarily cooperate. What's interesting there is that when you look at what the colonists are actually saying, when they see like a Stamp Act tax being imposed upon them, what they say is not, we are Americans and we're different from you and you shouldn't do this. What they say is, we're British subjects. British subjects have rights. They have rights in Britain. They have rights in North America. You can't treat good British subjects of the king like this, which is largely Murren's point. The very way in which they can understand that what's being done to them is wrong is because they've so completely embraced their own British identity. It's what gives them the language and the framework to be able to work out why they aren't being treated as British subjects should be. And when they first start arguing with the empire, what they're really arguing about is that the empire should be extending them the same rights and privileges and respect that all British subjects deserve, and they are also very much British subjects.
And what you're describing, what Murren describes in the book, and just going to put it into words as he did, is what started as a constitutional argument became a full-blown war for independence. Talk about that a little bit. What you just described are things that could be addressed in a constitution,
right,
are in, addressed in the American Constitution,
right,
years,
right,
later.
Right.
And even some of the things that you mentioned are addressed in the Declaration of Independence. But why a constitutional argument that became a full-blown war?
Right. And so what we mean by that phrase, constitutional argument, the British don't have a written constitution in the way that we do. In fact, one of the things we decide to do as a result of these conflicts is write out what we think our fundamental constitutional statements are, so there can be no disagreement or ambiguity about them. Well, it turns out there still is, but, you know, we think that there won't be. And so fundamentally, what this becomes is, it turns out that there's a sort of different ways to think about what British rights are. And what the American colonists argue is that the long-standing right that British subjects have is to be, as John Locke said, to be secure in their life, liberty, and property. And the way in which, in the British tradition, subjects are secure in their property, the way that people understand that a subject might have his property rights violated, is if the government began to take away property without his consent. And the most obvious way a government might do that is through taxation. If a government didn't have any control over the way it taxed, it could begin to tax away all of your property, and suddenly you wouldn't be safe in your property any longer. And this is where this British idea, and it originates in Britain, not in the North American colonies, this idea of taxation connected to representation comes in. Because what the British will say, and they're saying this in the 17th century, they're saying this long before there's any serious American colonial development at all, is that the way that a subject can be secure in his property and the state can also have the power to tax, which states need to do, they need to tax and raise revenue to fight wars and do all the other things they do, is that you have to have the power to tax connected to two things. And the first is that the people who are doing the taxing have to be elected by the taxpayers. I mean, if they are voted in and they behave badly, the voters can vote them out. So that's one way to sort of put a check upon the power to tax. And the second is that the people who are voted in and doing the taxing should be obligated to pay the same taxes that the rest of the nation has to pay. So if both of those things are true, if the people who tax are voted in, and if they have to pay the same taxes they expect other people to pay, they'll never tax in ways that are dangerous and bad because they'd be hurting themselves. And what that means is that the only, in British politics, the only body that meets both of those requirements is the British House of Commons, the lower house in Parliament, which is the elected body. So the House of Lords sits by hereditary right. They're not elected, so they don't meet one of the requirements. And the king doesn't pay taxes. He's the state who receives it, so he doesn't meet it either. Now, what the colonists start to believe, when Parliament begins to impose taxes on them, they say, well, wait a second, because we're British subjects, we have the same rights. We have the same right to be secure in our property. There should be no taxation without representation. But we're 3,000 miles in an ocean away, and we don't send members to the House of Commons. We have our own colonial legislatures. So if Britain cared about its own values, its own beliefs, and its own rights as much as we did, if it was true to British liberty in the same way that we're being true to British liberty, it would realize that because the House of Commons doesn't meet those same requirements for colonists as it does for people living in the British Isles, that it shouldn't expect to tax colonists, which is not American colonists saying that they don't expect to pay taxes. In fact, they pay a lot of taxes. What they're saying is it would be as improper for the British House of Commons to tax a resident in Pennsylvania as it would be for the Virginia legislature to tax a resident of Pennsylvania. In every case, any British subject should expect that when he pays taxes, both of those two criteria are true, that he's voted for the taxer, and the taxer taxing him has to pay the same taxes. And when that's the case, British liberty is being protected, and that we deserve that as much as any resident of Britain.
But still, that is a big jump from feeling that taxes are unfair and that the British citizens in the colonies don't have the same rights as those in Great Britain itself, in England itself. So when does that move toward arms actually occur?
Right. So what happens is that, the British passed taxes anyway in 1764 and 65, and it's a complicated process, and there's a great deal of American resistance. And the biggest and most angering tax, the Stamp Act, actually is repealed. And as a result, what happens is that a new ministry comes in that actually is it's a very interesting ministry. It's led by a man named the Marquess of Rockingham, who is a sort of in the tradition of William Pitt, who, remember, had made everything work so well during the Seven Years' War. And Rockingham actually brings peace to the empire. He sort of retreats from a lot of these demands. He kind of acknowledges that the British subjects of the colonies actually have a pretty good point. And then in the late 1760s, some new additional taxes are passed. And that's sort of an escalation of the crisis, because when the colonists sort of have, when peace is restored after the Stamp Act crisis, colonists largely think, well, we were right. We said what we felt was right. We were heard. We were listened to. This actually demonstrates that the British Empire is a healthy empire with a good political structure in which our British liberties are respected and we're listened to and heard. So the second time the taxes are enacted begins to seem much more dangerous to them. Because they think, well, wait a second, we've already explained very clearly, we thought we were heard about why this is a violation of British liberty. But again, no, they're still defending their own British liberty. They're still saying, we're British subjects who aren't being treated as British subjects should be treated. As long as they're thinking that, they're not really looking to leave the British Empire. What they're calling upon the British Empire to do is live up to its own values, which ironically they think they embody better than people living in Britain do. But the second crisis, which is called the Townshend Acts crisis, it's named after the man Charles Townshend, is largely the architect of these new taxes, is a real escalation. I mean, people are not, they're not as willing to give British policymakers the benefit of the doubt. And one of the biggest taxes that's enacted in that second series of taxes is a tax on tea, which probably people are already realizing where that leads to. And ultimately, through a complicated series of developments, it's this taxed tea that people in Boston a few years later in 1773 are throwing over the harbor and destroying in what's known as the Boston Tea Party. And for the British, that becomes the last straw. What they don't see is loyal British subjects demanding that Parliament live up to its own values. What they see is rebellious, dangerous malcontents who have overthrown the rule of law and destroyed property and, in fact, probably are plotting to leave the empire. What's interesting is people in Britain accuse the American colonists of plotting to leave the empire before, and most people in the American colonies actually want to leave the empire. But the result, the reaction to the Boston Tea Party, is a series of very, very powerful and draconian punishing acts, which the Americans call the Intolerable Acts, but even the British themselves call the Coercive Acts. So the British are not denying that these are very, very powerful acts. They close down Boston Port, which throws into unemployment over half the city, and won't let Boston Port be open again until all the tea is paid for. They amend the Massachusetts Colonial Charter, which many people in Massachusetts felt was a sort of sacred contract that shouldn't be changed. They limit the number of town meetings that can be met. They actually make the general who's in charge of the troops in North America the governor of Massachusetts, which sort of looks like martial law. They do a number of things like that, and that's what leads to the First Continental Congress, in the sense that, wait a second here, we might have misjudged our confidence that British liberty was safe with Parliament. In fact, Parliament might have become such a corrupt body that it no longer cares for British liberty. The irony here is that when the Americans start moving towards really thinking they have to maybe defend themselves more vigorously than they did before, and maybe even take up arms and fight, what they become convinced of is that they're the only true good British subjects left in the world. The liberty they thought Britain cared for, actually only North Americans care for, while the British have become a corrupt society that no longer respects its own stated values.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Our guest during this portion of the program is history professor Dr. Andrew Shankman to discuss rethinking America from empire to republic. So you were talking about some colonists who were thinking about taking up arms, and actually what was creeping into their minds was maybe independence. But at the same time, what you're describing, how often have you used the word Boston? This was a New England war for the most part. And the rest of the colonies, even though there was a Continental Congress, the rest of the colonies, there were many people here who thought, okay, New England, they're the real revolutionaries here. They're the ones causing problems. We have no problem with Britain right now. What about that?
Well, yeah, what's interesting is that's clearly what the policymakers in Britain think is going to happen. Because when you look at those coercive acts, they're only punishing Massachusetts. And the assumption is that Massachusetts is this radical, crazy place. It's got the Adams and it's got Hancock. Okay, they're ungovernable. But we can demonstrate to the rest of the colonies, look, we understand that they're the problem. We're not punishing you. But in fact, those coercive acts are such powerful, punishing acts that they force all of the colonists to start rethinking their what they think their relationship with Britain is. Every colony has a colonial charter. And when it becomes clear that Parliament feels that its rights include being able to rewrite those colonial charters at will, then every colony has to be concerned. Then suddenly you wonder what the rule of law is. When they close down an entire city's port, well, then the ports of New York and Philadelphia also have to be concerned. And it's also the case that while New England and particularly Massachusetts have been sort of the heart of resistance to this point, there have been plenty of other examples of resistance in the previous 10 years in other places. There had been Stamp Act riots in New York, in Philadelphia, in Charleston, South Carolina, in Baltimore. So when the coercive acts get passed, and there's the call in 1774 for a First Continental Congress, there are colonies from each of the regions, from New England, from the Middle Atlantic, and from the South, who feel they need to send representatives. And very quickly, in fact, there's a very strong Virginia delegation in 1774, and then in the Second Continental Congress of 1775, that is determined to make it clear that they will stand with Massachusetts, that the coercive acts have suggested that maybe Parliament no longer does protect British liberty, but in fact might even be one of the biggest threats to British liberty.
Any idea the breakdown of those who favored revolution, favored independence, versus those who were loyalists and wanted to stay with Great Britain?
there's been a lot of really fascinating work on loyalists in the past 10 years. And what it's shown is that this can be a very, very principled debate. And in fact, there are people who are deeply critical of what Parliament is doing in the 1760s and early 1770s, who still, when push comes to shove, feel, wait, I can't really violate my loyalty to my king and remain loyal. So there's deep principle on both sides. I think that by 17, and a lot changes between 1774 and 1776. Those are two very, very big and violent and sort of angry years. By 1776, what I can say with confidence is that a statistic that tends to get bandied about, which is that one-third were loyal, one-third were supportive, and one-third were indifferent, is actually wrong. That comes from a claim of John Adams. And in fact, when you trace back to what he was saying, he was actually talking about American attitudes towards the French Revolution. So he never meant to say that about the American Revolution. I think that we can say with some confidence by 1776 that the majority of Americans have become profoundly dissatisfied with the nature of the British, the relationship with Britain. But I think that you can find a sizable minority, and if I have to put a percentage on it, I would say perhaps maybe 30% at least, who don't wish to break with Great Britain. And in fact, one of the more interesting and lesser-known aspects of the first couple years of the war is the really vicious infighting within the American colonies, now independently declared states, between those who are still loyal to Britain and those who are not. There's real, real anger and mistrust in places like New Jersey. It becomes very, very violent in the South when the war turns there in 1779 and 1780. I mean, thorough civil partisan war between armed groups that are both loyal or to the Patriot cause or loyal to Britain. So, and in fact, what happens, the reason why this violence doesn't continue after the war ends is because so many loyalists are no longer safe and leave. You get a real mass exodus of former North American, of former sort of members of the 13 colonies to what's now Canada. And that actually becomes one of the first real sizable English-speaking populations of Canada. I mean, Canada had been French right up until just before the Revolution, and most of the people living in Canada were still French speakers. The real first rise of an English-speaking population in Canada is these loyalists who are leaving because they're not safe in North America, in the United States any longer.
After America won its independence and a constitution was adopted in Philadelphia, the founders' assumptions about what would emerge was much different than the society that did come about. In what way?
Well, yeah, and Murren has a number of essays. The last sort of several essays in the book really deal with the unexpected consequences of all of this. So, to a great extent, what we call the founders, a lot of what they think they need to accomplish by 1787 when they go to Philadelphia and hammer out the Constitution, a lot of their thinking has been shaped not so much by the Revolution, although it has to some extent, but really by the decade of experience after the Revolution. Because what the American Revolution ends up doing is becoming a profoundly disruptive event. It's a very, very long and difficult and bloody and violent war. It takes a terrible economic and social toll. The society is dramatically transformed as a result of it. To a great extent, it's because the government that people could expect to have in the colonies, a government that was in each colony that was largely, you know, stable and hierarchical, and in which ordinary folk tended to pay deference to people who were wealthier and more prominent among them, all of that government in lots of places for many, many years just simply disintegrates. And you have all over the place little villages governing themselves, little parts of states governing themselves, lots and lots of ordinary folk taking on the authority of self-government. And when the American Revolutionary War ended, many of them didn't want to give up that authority. And so you can see in all kinds of ways in the 1780s, governments beginning to look very different than they had prior to the American Revolution. One classic study shows that it just sort of examines who was getting elected to colonial legislatures in the 1760s and compares it to who was getting elected to state legislatures after the Revolution in the 1780s. And what the study found was that in every region, in New England, in the Mid-Atlantic, in the South, in every legislature you could look at, after the Revolution, the typical person getting elected was poorer, closer to the average small landowner, had less formal education, was much more of an ordinary sort of white male citizen landowner. And clearly what's happening is that a lot of these revolutionized American citizens are electing people like themselves and asking them to address concerns and interests they have. And one of the most profound concerns they have is just how economically disastrous the Revolution had been. They're suddenly cast out of this British Empire. The British are punishing them with all kinds of, you know, punitive laws and prohibitions upon them. One historian has really called the decade after the Revolution the first Great American Depression, and has really shown that that depression is as savage, probably more savage, actually, than the depression of the 1930s. So what a lot of these ordinary Americans want in the 1780s is their state legislatures to reflect them, to look like them, to have the same kinds of concerns they have, and pass all kinds of laws for debt relief, all kinds of laws to prevent the collection of debts, to maybe even cancel debts out, you know, so to sort of redistribute property to save small people at the expense of wealthy people. There's all kinds of ways, all kinds of demands that are being made, and a lot of that actually is really frightening to people like James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. And they have principled reasons why. I mean, someone like James Madison, looking at a lot of the legislation in the 1780s, would argue that when the state intervenes in a private contract between someone who's borrowed and someone who's lent, a creditor and a debtor, and the state, you know, the government prevents the creditor from receiving back what he lent, someone like James Madison would say, well, the state's now enabling private, you know, is violating the rights of private property. It's enabling someone to not pay back, you know, and not respect the rights of property. And how exactly is that different from when the British were violating our rights of property? It's no different. So we can't have a government that violates the same natural rights as the one that we rejected for doing so. And that's a really powerful and compelling argument. On the other hand, I mean, the very small farmers who need this legislation can say, well, you know, we fought and bled and died to make the revolution happen, and, you know, the government was so poor it couldn't even pay us, or it couldn't pay us for the services we provided when we gave it food, or we sewed clothing, or we made arms, or we built wagons. And because we've never been paid, and now this government can't protect our markets and can't stand up to the British, and we're being squeezed, the result of the revolution will be that we'll become destitute and landless and have no way to protect ourselves or our families. How can that be a viable revolutionary experience? And so clearly our governments are now free to protect us, and they should. And that's also a very compelling argument. So that's why in the 1780s these conflicts are so charged. But what people like the founders want to do is try to recreate some of the stability and order and hierarchy that the revolution has disrupted. And the way that they think to do that is to create a much stronger national government that will be able to assert some sort of control over and limit the degree to which the state governments and their state legislatures can do a lot of the things that they are doing during the 1780s.
But Murren writes that what the founders did and some of the decisions that were made by those who wrote the Constitution, that it led directly to the American Civil War. In what way?
Well, yeah. So he—that's one of the essays towards the end, and he likes to make very profound statements and then force us to think about them. So one of the things he's arguing about there is that one of the things that the Constitution doesn't do is it doesn't. What the Constitution does is it kind of doesn't create, but it because this has already happened, but it sort of accepts and places into the document itself a reality that slavery had become a sectional institution as a result of the Revolution. So it started at the start of 1776. Slavery was legal in every state. It's legal in Massachusetts. It's legal in New York. Legal in Pennsylvania. And legal in all the southern states. And what happens as a result of the Revolution, a lot of it being revolutionary ideology, revolutionary belief, is that the states where slavery is not essential, so essentially states north of Delaware, begin the process as a result of sort of listening seriously to revolutionary ideology, all men created equal, etc., etc. There's one British thinker, a man named Samuel Johnson, when he first reads the Declaration of Independence, his response is to say, well, how can we take seriously these yelps for liberty from the drivers of Negroes? So it's not the case that people at the time weren't capable of seeing contradiction between declaring all men equal and owning a slave. Samuel Johnson can see it. Plenty of Americans can see it. And what happens between 1780 and 1804 is that every state north of Delaware starts the process of abolishing slavery. And that's really a result of the Revolution. And so slavery, one major impact of the American Revolution is that slavery, which had been illegal, a national institution, legal everywhere, really becomes a sectional institution. And what Murren is talking about when he talks about the Constitution is that the Constitution in many ways is codifying that the United States will become a nation that's half slave and half free. It's got various different provisions within the Constitution which acknowledge the reality of slavery. They never use the term, which is interesting. But they use a lot of euphemisms, persons of permanent servitude, et cetera, et cetera. So within the Constitution, there's several key instances where essentially they acknowledge and codify the reality that slavery is one, it exists in one part of the nation and doesn't in another. And that really is kind of a sort of foundational reality that will, over time, metastasize and lead to greater and greater sectional conflict. Now, what Murren's statement doesn't mean, and what I know for a fact John Murren doesn't believe, is that because of what happened in the 1780s, that what happened in the 1860s had to happen in precisely the way it does. John Murren is famous for insisting that every generation of the historical process needs to have its own history, that there's lots of different possibilities, that nothing is inevitable. So he would never want to say you don't have to think about and do the careful work of studying the 1820s, the 1830s, the 1840s. But he does mean that the way in which slavery becomes a sectional institution as a result of the Revolution invites the strong likelihood of some kind of sectional disagreement, which could lead to sectional conflict over time.
History professor Dr. Andrew Shankman. Dr. Shankman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
The book is Rethinking America from Empire to Republic. Fascinating.
Thank you so much.